Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Some suggestions for how to do this, how to do metta. That would be a good idea. How do you talk for 8 days, 9 days on metta and not actually say how to do it? So the beauty of metta is also that it's not, it can turn into something jhanic, you know, profound stillness with the absence of thought, but you can't initiate it and develop it without using discursive activity, some sort of processes of the mind. So it's a very beautiful thing, and it's somewhat, and not surprisingly, like art. It is a work of art, and it's the kind of artists have to, I mean, if they're real artists, great art is always has a moral dimension to it. Nothing moves you and has any real meaning except deep moral concerns about what the highest values of your life are. So in the same way, you're working on a piece of art, and it's a beautiful thing to have that feel like you go into your studio and you have to face that blank canvas. Well, sometimes the canvas isn't blank, it's actually full of nightmarish figures. Could be ink blots, you know, that look like bats or demons. It would be nice if we could even just start with neutrality, but lots of people don't start with neutrality. They start with angst, anguish. They start with stories that have been cycling their whole lives, and they wonder, sometimes not very hopefully, if they can ever get over it or get past these constructs that seem so real about themselves. So it certainly cheers you up when you come to Buddhist ideas and then they say, well, by the way, there is no self. Well, that's nice to hear. It would be real tragedy if you just had, you were stuck with that thing. It was a real thing? No, it's not a real thing. It's that also, of course, the idea that there isn't a real self is bizarre, scary, strange, hopeful. If you hear it in the right way, it's liberating. If you hear it in the wrong way, then it's just strange. But it's always meant to be liberating. The Buddha is always saying, now, this might sound strange at first, but it's really the only reason why there is hope, is that there isn't any really solid, substantial, real core self. And then he says, now, since that's the case, you can be creative and imaginative, and other people have thought through this, and they have some good suggestions. It's kind of like a waiter coming to your table in a good restaurant, and then you look at maybe you're not a gourmet diner, but you look at the thing, and you say, what do you recommend? Oh, this is lovely, that's beautiful, so forth. So it's nice. The Buddha is saying, you know, have you tried the metta? Man, you can have it as an appetizer if you want, or a dessert. You can have it as a main course. It's just so versatile. It's delicious. You never get tired of it. It's the bread of life. Very nourishing. You can share it with others. Once you get into baking bread, some of our stewards discover the making bread, and they get a lot of positive feedback. Who doesn't like fresh bread? So you get to share that and share the benefits of your loving kindness as well. You get somebody who has loving kindness, they really talk about it almost as the smell of fresh bread, like around somebody who's got that good-heartedness. It is as wholesome as the smell of fresh baked bread, isn't it? There are many techniques, but the first one is pretend you're somebody else. And so the Buddha talks about this, like, in some ways, you know, if you have not developed loving kindness, it's because of your idea of who you are. I mean, after you've heard about loving kindness and you find some resistance to it, it's probably because who you think you are, that you're not that kind of person, like not the way you think about things. You have a few people that you like from time to time, and then other people you don't like, and that's a normal kind of thing, and you get by, you know, but you're not walking around in a cloud of divinity or light radiating out or anything like that. It's just a kind of a more of a survival mode. So you'd think, how maybe that's for others, but how am I supposed to do that? Well, all you do is just say, okay, let's pretend I'm not me. Let's pretend I'm Gandhi. Now, nobody has to know about this. You don't have to tell anybody that you're Gandhi for the next few hours. Or whatever, whoever you like. I was telling you about St. Francis, so, you know, he's talking to the birds, and, you know, he's kind of overspilling with love. So that's a nice one. You see the statues, he's got his arms open, he's kissing lepers, and he has this friend, Brother Juniper, who is also a bit wiggy. I guess wiggy's the wrong word, because they're all shaved. But Brother Juniper is turned on as well. He's basically into the love thing, and he is taking everything seriously that Jesus said. And so he's joined the Franciscan order, and they're really letting go of everything. And one day Brother Juniper goes out, and there's a guy that has no shirt. And so it says in the Bible, if somebody has no shirt, give him your shirt. So the Franciscans only had one robe, so Brother Juniper pulls off his robe, stark naked, and gives this guy, this beggar, his robe, and the beggar puts it on, and Juniper walks around naked. And right, they did not even shoes, because they went barefoot. The original Franciscans, they were committed to being barefoot, so he comes back naked. And, you know, of course, in monasteries, I mean, it's the same in all monasteries. There's a whole spectrum of people who show up to want to be monks, right? So, and some of them are just a little nuts. So Juniper's, everybody's new in this, so they're thinking, oh, somebody's gone off again, you know? Juniper explains, well, I ran into a guy with no shirt, so I gave him my robe, and that's why I'm naked. So, okay, well, here's another robe then. So, and in fact, he did it again. It wasn't 4 days later that somebody had no shirt, and Juniper comes back naked again, and then St. Francis starts the development of the rules. So you're simply not allowed, even if somebody else is naked, you're not allowed to give your one robe away. And so you'll have to work it out some other way. You know, find somebody who will give the guy a shirt or whatever. But this is actually similar to the development of rules for monks. All these kind of things people make, sometimes radically good, you know, with a lot of goodwill behind it, but not a lot of circumspection, you know, like not a sense of the appropriate. So the Buddha has to say, well, that was very kind of you, but I, you know, that we can't be doing that all the time. So, and sometimes they're operating on their defilements and so forth. But anyway, so Juniper is, you know, this is a guy who's happy to give everything away and walk away naked. You know, he's in the right profession, all right. He's St. Francis's friend, and he accompanies him around a little. But Francis is even worse in a better way. So he's just so transfixed by loving kindness that when he gets into a state of loving kindness, he starts floating off the ground. And this is like his eyes are rolling back in his head, and he's floating up into the air until Juniper. So this is what Juniper said. He had to grab him by his feet to keep him from floating away. Bring him back down to the ground. Now, that's a friend. That's what a friend does for you. When you start to float above the sidewalks of Portland, dangling in the air with loving kindness, it would be nice to have a juniper around who can just pull you back down to the ground. That'll have to be another Sangha member who will understand what you're doing. Anyway, this is, you can be either Juniper or St. Francis, just be somebody else for a while and walk around and just think, what would it be like to be one of these guys? There's all kinds of course, you can be Mother Teresa on the streets of, looking out this, she's from a cloistered monastery originally, contemplative monastery, but she was looking out the window of a train in India at just the absolute street devastation of people's lives, and she just said, I have to step out of this cloister and just, if I can only rescue one or two, that'd be fine. If I can bring them in off the street, but I've got to do something here. So she started to do that. And she was asked, you know, what keeps you going? And she said, well, we meditate, you know, about 4 hours a day as a community. So in the morning and in the evening. And we live in a very clean and orderly environment, which allows us to recharge our batteries, and we would never last if we didn't meditate. So whatever form that took, but a significant portion of the day. So it's not just a street worker, social worker, but, and she said, it's not about that somebody's going to survive or anything. It's each one of these beggars or lepers or starving children or anything that we pick up is Jesus. It's not really anybody that we're just, each one is this kind of spirit. And I don't intend to cure the problem of poverty either, she said. She quoted Jesus that the poor shall always be with you. And she said, I wouldn't want to contradict Jesus. So I'm not thinking, when is this going to be over? Like, when am I going to finally get the last impoverished kid off the street? She had no intention of ever doing that. She said, well, I'd be out of a job, wouldn't I? So it's an equanimous type of loving kindness, which is just, it's not frustrated with the failures of the world. So you can find your character. There's all kinds of marvelous stories about people in history, and of course there's stories of the monks as well. Ananda was full of loving kindness, and the Buddha, of course. And in general, the reputation of the monks was very good for just being, you know, not threatening. When you saw the monks, you were never afraid, you know. Even to the extent of, even the animals were not afraid. So this is something to walk around and say, you know, just to yourself, like, no one needs to be afraid of me. So you can do that, you know. You can specialize, like in marmots, if you want. Whatever. I mean, it's just such it's an art project, isn't it? It's not like we're going to fix the world. That's a very frustrating project. You're not going to fix the world. But you're going to have a loving encounter with a lot of beings, and they may respond, they may not. You just set it aside. It's your spiritual work. And if you need to be somebody else in order to break out of your own reservations about this, then you just pretend to be somebody else. I mean, this is just normal human behavior. If you go to an acting class, they're going to have you pretend to be somebody else all the time. we're pretending all the time. Who are we anyway? We're somebody with our boss, and then we're somebody with our mother, and then we're somebody with our girlfriend, and then we're somebody with our child. And so we have roles. And so you can use your imagination and act yourself out of this. And so this was induction. So this is also the practice of imagination. And the Buddha, the instruction we had is imagine radiating to the four quarters, to the first quarter. I mean, this is to the south, radiating to the north, to the east, to the west. Imagine all the beings out there is out to the north, to the south. So he's offering you some imaginative exercises here to use your imagination to cultivate this. So this is not just watching the breath or something. This is, you've got to understand that different meditation topics require different structures for development. It requires mindfulness in that the fact that you want to remember what you're doing. You are practicing loving kindness, and you're kind of not just thinking for a minute or something like this. It's like you're working on this story. You have to find material that speaks to you. It's quite legitimate. In these days, they didn't have books, so the Buddha couldn't say, recommend, read a story. But he obviously is recommending hear a story. What is it? Why should he instruct people to go to the temples, to the monasteries, and hear the Dhamma? And when you hear the Dhamma, what do you expect to be hearing? What is a person? He's telling the lay people, go on the apositas, go once a week or once or at least every couple of weeks and spend some time there and hear, listen, ask the monk to talk to you. We just did this historical thing. I was asked in Pali to give a talk, And so go to the monasteries, ask them to talk to you about Dhamma. And what are they going to do? They got their largest collection of stories in human history. I mean, it's collections and collections of stories. They're going to tell you stories that move you, that help your imagination to find your way into this new way of thinking. If you read Charles Dickens about the state of, child welfare in 19th century England, when 7-year-olds had to work 12 hours a day in factories, you will be moved. And you're moved. In fact, maybe the industrial period of abuse of human labor and children ended because of literature like Dickens, Charles Dickens. Because when people read that, they could see through the eyes of a higher development, a higher being. Normally people are like, everybody's got to make a living and it's hard and whatever, it's good for them, So you can get very unsympathetic about all this, but he's helping you walk through a vision towards the opening of the heart and seeing into the suffering of other beings and understanding what it's like to be a child that is overworked and can't do anything about it and so forth. So this is what you need to do, is enrich your stockhouse of stories and use those stories to get you there, to find your way there. And when you're dry, somebody else is full. Your imagination's not always available to you, so use exterior. Listen to a Dhamma talk on metta. Just have it playing in the background, Have a little stockpile of them. It's like being an amateur musician. You just find time for it, and you listen, and you play, and you can you go and get, you go to your teacher and you get some feedback, and you're working on a project here. So you can also use your memory, and of course, you're in your own life, if you could go back and do certain things differently, what would you do? And a lot of the times, you know, it's mostly you probably wouldn't get all that angry or uptight or worried and everything if you had to do it over again, because it was all wasn't worth it. And that a lot of encounters could have been a lot more friendly, could have been a lot more tolerant, a lot more forgiving. And then if you look at your own assessments of yourself in retrospect when you were young, then also, you know, the things that you thought about yourself and the harsh criticisms you had and everything, from this point of view, you think, well, this a youngster, 20-year-old, what do they know, 25, you don't know anything. You're all just confused and don't know any better and stuff like that. So it's a, you can go back and bless yourself through, and you can practice loving kindness for yourself. You can go and sit on a park bench with your 21-year-old self and say, so how's it going? Anything going on in your life? Maybe I have a few suggestions. So you can feel free to, you know, of course, spiritual life, spiritual, the Dhamma is full of imagination and full of, beyond, they're not interested really in a lot of realism. They're not interested in science or even that much in logic. So you find a different kind of language, very creative and boundless, boundaryless. They go to different realms. They go to the heavens. They converse with the angels. They get visits from the angels. They encounter ghosts, and they talk to them and offer condolences. And they're not, there's no fear. They just have empathy and sympathy for beings. So you see, the Buddha is ranging through the whole spectrum of possibilities of the deepest kind of suffering to the exquisite beauty of goodness and generosity and all of these things. And so this is the expanded imagination and consciousness. And you expand your consciousness through imagination. You start being not so concerned with the truth about these stories, but more, they're not really true stories, but they're stories about truth. They're truer than true stories, as art is. I mean, a lot of art is like, that's not what a forest looks like. But in this strange way, it is how I feel about the forest. It captures more about the forest than if you photographed it. And even, of course, the photograph can be, it's the timing, it's the light and everything. Because what is a forest? It's there isn't a forest. It's a moment to do with light and your feeling and so forth. So you'll see in paintings, forests sometimes are very gloomy and dark. Sometimes they're open and shafts of light coming through them. Sometimes there's other beings in them. Sometimes they're scary, forbidding, and so forth. Because there is no such thing as a forest apart from your relationship to this thing. And so this is, you got to recognize the possibilities of creativity with the mind and the heart and the emotions, and go to explore this. So the teachings are full of creative exercises And there is a teaching also called Deva Nusati, which is the recollection of the of angels or radiant beings from higher dimensions. And also with that, in the Tibetan tradition, you spend quite a bit of time pretending you're a god. With every detail, you imagine what your fingernails look like and the color of your skin and your radiant. You turn yourself into, it's called deity practice. So they're systematically with their imagination, you got to fully imagine yourself as a deity. In the end, they make sure that you understand even the deities are empty of self. There's no reality to any of this, including you. There's no substance to any of this. But they pull you out of your conviction about a real self by saying, you know, look, you just were a deity for a while, weren't you? And if you, this is an exquisitely detailed practice that they spend. You can spend years doing this, but we can, and you see where the roots of that are. They're in right from the Buddha. This Deva Nusati, the mindfulness of the devas. You can interpret that as mindfulness of devas out there, you know. But also, you can do it, and probably it's closer to it is mindfulness of your own devic qualities. What are those devic qualities? What are those light being qualities? What are those angelic qualities? Just generosity. It's quite simple. It's quite easy. From a Buddhist point of view, it's quite easy to get into heaven. Just one good act of generosity is enough. When you go back and recall that, if it's strong, it's transformative of your consciousness. It's enough to produce heaven, to a full act of sharing and giving with love and with sincerity, with joy, before, during, after. That's enough to produce the devic consciousness, the Brahma Vihara, the place where the gods live. And metta is a Brahma Vihara. You're trying to become an angel. You're going to move into the... They're very nice descriptions of the places they live. They actually... they're very close to spaceships, really. It's hard not to notice that sounds like a spaceship. They're kind of glass palaces that float around, actually. They move wherever you want them to. And they're flooded with lights, different colored lights. Red lights, blinking lights. And they float in the air. And you're in them, and you're tall and beautiful and transparent and luminous. Any suggestion that sounds like a spaceship is purely coincidence. So they are a vihara, so they're dwelling. They're a place, a mansion, of a place where you go and dwell. And this is, of course, what... Why bring some sort of sour, skeptical stuff to this? Like, what do you want to ruin the party? I mean, it's not math. It's not physics either. It's something else, which if you want to find a life in math and physics, good luck with that. Even Einstein mostly played his violin and had casual affairs. You know, like, physics is not a... You can't live on physics. You can't. It's just not enough. So humans are much more than that. We need, and we can enter into different realms. And we shouldn't be so we should just realize there's other parts of our mind and other parts of our brain. And when we step into it, it's like, I never want to leave this place. This is life. This is what I always hoped it would be. And kids, like young kids, are much more able to just do that. They don't have any, they don't have a boundaries, you know. This is why you can't actually do magic for young kids. There's, when you're five, there's no reason a rabbit shouldn't come out of a hat. So, it's nice a rabbit came out of a hat, you know. And, you know, when you're an adult, you think, how did that happen? You know, it's that was good because that breaks all the laws of physics. But the kid, the five-year-old, has no laws of physics. There are no boundaries. So you don't want to get carried away. The laws of physics have a certain explicitly narrow application in the human life, you know. It's very good for certain things, but not for everything. It just doesn't work that way. The boundaries of the laws of physics and everything must be set aside for. There's another enlivened and much superior dimension. Physics can be kept as a kind of a curious hobby. It's a charming little game, but it's just, you know, you can fiddle around for an afternoon. It's like playing solitaire or something. 2 and 2 is 4, and 4, if you divide it in half, it'd be 2 again. That's wonderful. So, who thought of that? So, you know, the original mathematicians like Pythagoras and so forth, they weren't mathematicians. They were mystics. And when they discovered the principles of mathematics, and especially geometric shapes, that there were constant, like you could access the triangle and so forth through formulas. This wasn't because they were interested in math. This was an indication of sublime truth in the universe, like mystical truth. Pythagoras apparently was a celibate. And he was so weird, so spiritual, they apparently did away with him at some point. But it wasn't about the usefulness of math. It was about the mysterious, revealing truth about the universe. That was what it was. It carried you away. It put you in ecstasies and trances. Now, that's the same thing with Plato as well. He was a geometrician. He had decided that there's only 20 different geometric shapes describe the entire everything in the universe. Now that he would have been floating like St. Francis a lot. It wasn't that he was going to use the geometry to do much. He wasn't a practical person. It just blew his mind. It just transported him. That was the, you know, the function of it. It was a religious experience for him. It wasn't a scientific or mathematic experience. So we inherit all this stuff. We're told that it's very good, very important, and everything, but all we can do is to make it applied. We apply our mathematics and our physics. We apply it, and in a kind of a very practical way, which is not very exalted. It can't give you that ecstasy. So the Buddha is calling you again and again to expand your imagination and to redo your life. Go back. If you're going to remember anything, go back and see how it could have been easier, could have been better, could have been sweeter, and learn the lesson from it and say, well, you know, I won't make those mistakes again. I won't choke this time. I won't get lost in the details. I won't get over serious about it, because last time I got over serious, and then a year later I was laughing about it. You know, so what why don't I learn the lesson? You know, why don't I laugh now instead of wait a year? So this is the, this is the how to work the clay of loving kindness is you're shaping this thing. You're playing with it. That's the way. And get yourself a bag of stories as well to go back and you can never hear these stories too many times. And whatever moves you, lifts you, frees you, opens you, and see how far you can get carried away. And you really won't be, don't worry, you won't be inappropriate. That's the thing is, everything, like, I know I have to watch this because then I could get strange and so forth, but you won't. You might get a little strange, but in a good way. People say, you know, you've changed, you know, you're, I like it, you know, it's good. Yeah. Next time, take me along on that retreat thing you do, because you came back all kind of glowy. So that's kind of a few things about how to do metta. So I'll leave that for tonight.